This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the cops in Sacramento, California, shot Stephen Clark in the back in his grandmother's backyard, sparking protests all across the country, including New York City. And a New Jersey judge sides with the police union, ruling that a community complaint review board violates the due process rights of cops.
But first, President Trump alarmed lots of people when he appointed the serial warmonger John Bolton as his national security advisor. Bolton has urged military attacks on both North Korea and Iran. Sarah Flounders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, says the U.S. empire is in a state of disarray, confusion, and desperation.
There seems to be a crisis underway in every level of U.S. policy today. Enormous frustration that U.S. imperialism can't control the whole world and forces are breaking out beyond their control everywhere. And the only solutions they can put forward are war, war and more war. And that's really what's reflected in the new appointment of Bolton, National Security Advisor. You wonder why someone so absolutely discredited from every side, even a huge concern to the right wing, let alone forces all over. He's called the Hawk's Hawk, an ultra-rightist war criminal, unrepentant supporter and defender of U.S. war in Iraq that killed millions of people, displaced millions of people. And here they are back again, this whole crew of Bolton and Pompeo, Gina Haskell to head the CIA, who ran a torture operation, unrepentant. And it is a real concern when you look at what's happening with the expected visit of Trump to Democratic People's Republic of Korea for a meeting with Kim Jong-un, to name someone like Bolton. Now, his most well-known recent article is The Legal Case for Striking North Korea First, and it is calling for a preemptive strike. And it's saying that is what is needed against North Korea is what Israel's destruction of Iraq's reactor back in 1981, or the bombing of Syria's nuclear reactor back in 2007. In other words, the very idea that any country has the right to develop nuclear energy or to defend themselves is what is coming under complete threat. And instead, there should be a preemptive massive destruction. This is what's being proposed by Bolton, and it's every reason to be concerned when such alt-right person is named national security. Now, what this visit is even meant to do, that's the bigger question, because it's hard to picture the U.S. in any serious discussions with People's Korea, given their frustration that Korea is determined to defend itself. Only want to deal with completely defenseless countries. Now, the visit to China is one more way of Democratic People's Republic of Korea defending itself and strengthening its alliances, particularly with China, such a vital ally, and making sure they're on the same page. In other words, that People's Korea isn't facing Trump alone, at least has a bigger ally next to them. And at the same time, recognizing their determination to set the terms of the discussion separate and apart from China. And they've made that clear. So where this is going is a bigger question. Where it's going in terms of will there be war, whether it's Iran, vastly expanded war with Syria, attack on Korea, or the very ominous threats the U.S. is making against China. I've never seen such a coming together of war threats and naming of the very provocateurs and war criminals of past times back into a new round of legitimacy in the U.S. today.
Well, certainly it is unclear what Donald Trump is looking forward to in these meetings with the North Koreans. But the North Koreans have always been demanding that the United States negotiate directly with them, and the U.S. has always refused.
That's certainly true, and this is an important moment for People's Korea, because their demand from the very beginning has been a peace accord, a peace treaty be signed. And the U.S. threats that have been unending, that are every single year, twice a year, in the military, what are called war games against People's Korea, with overflights and aircraft carriers and nuclear subs right off the coast and tens of thousands of troops in motion right on the border. This U.S. does every year. It's a big threat to People's Korea, and Korea has said, let's stop this, demand that it end, and demand that there be a peace agreement, a peace treaty finally signed, or that hasn't been signed in more than 60 years since the Korean War, a war that killed 4 million Koreans, a war that destroyed, literally leveled every city into rubble in the north, left millions of refugees, and traumatized the entire Korean Peninsula, North and South, that war, and the continuing threats since then. So there's a real aspiration for a peace agreement, a peace treaty, an end to the threats, and a demand that the threats end and that the U.S. talk with them directly. Will it happen? We don't know. We really don't know. And the real difficulty in trying to figure it out in the big corporate news today is they are attacking Trump from the right, calling for more threats on Russia, threats on Syria. From every direction, the Democratic Party is equally as bad. And while condemning Trump, went along with him on even on the huge tax breaks for the multi-billionaires, went along with him on the military budget, making a half-hearted little objection here and there of a few of the more liberal members, but Democratic Party overwhelmingly voted the military budget and the tax breaks and has called for more threats in the media. Now, that is what is most dangerous to me, this coming together, because imperialist wars are not mistakes. They're driven by the internal needs of a system. This is a system in serious decay and frantic to restore its position, which it can't do. Even through war, it can't do.
Yes, and imperialist wars are driven by imperialist cultures in the imperial country. And we see that for decades, North Korea's been treated as some kind of, well, something ranging from a joke to a vampire nation, but never as a serious fellow country engaged in diplomacy.
That's absolutely true. There has been a refusal on the part of the U.S. again and again to in any way really deal with the people of the North, of People's Korea, because their total frustration and anger is that it's a socialist country existing outside the domination and control of U.S. corporate power. So they absolutely hate People's Korea, and they've done everything they can to destroy and isolate it. The most intense sanctions in the world are what is on North Korea today, and yet the country has managed to survive and in interesting ways to thrive, to more than feed its population and modern housing. And they want us to accept the idea that everyone in Korea is starving. And then visitor to Korea who travel, people who travel all through Korea will say that's not true and describe what they're seeing now. They went through years of hardship, real hardship, to survive as an independent and sovereign country. And all of this, I want to say, the extreme apprehension as to what Trump's newest appointments mean, what the threats on Russia and on China mean are driving whole parts of the movement here to desperately try to find ways to object, to protest, to come out, to come together. Demonstrations taking place nationally on April 14th to 15th in many cities across the country. One indication of that, I would really urge people to look at Spring Action 2018 for more information on that. But that's just one example. I think you could see it even in the big coming out of young people against the violence in schools. Now, of course, the military is a far bigger gun, doing far more to destroy U.S. schools and to undercut and to bankrupt them. So it's how to raise that to the young people coming out. And the police kill three times as many people as those who have died in these shootings. But nevertheless, speaking out against that, against the climate of violence, was an important step. It's how to bring more into it. But that extreme opposition to the climate of violence, military threat, is now palpable in the population as a whole. And I think it needs to be addressed.
How does one explain the Democrats who, of course, in recent decades have attempted to cling as closely to the Republican Party as possible, but now, as you say, have taken positions to the right and are more warlike than the Republicans, especially when we have a president that Democrats are portraying as being the most likely to begin a world war?
Both the Democrats and the Republicans are imperialist parties. They represent corporate power in the U.S. Now, the Democratic Party has a more progressive social base that it always has to address and masquerade as a party of the people. It's not at all. So how do they carry out tax cuts? Well, they certainly were able to do it in the Clinton administration, huge cuts in welfare that no Republican was ever able to carry out. And they were able to do it in the Trump administration by both objecting and going right along with the most extraordinary tax cuts in history. And the military budget that they vote for every single year, and they'll insist that they voted for it because they were bargaining for some minuscule health program or children's nutrition program, and that was the price they just had to pay. It's a total fraud, and yet there's great sophistication in carrying it out, and it lures a big part of the population into it. Lesser of two evils. You just got to go along with it. And it robs the movement of an independent voice again and again. It's probably the most dangerous because the sheer number of wars and attacks on the working class as a whole take place through the Democratic Party. Now, Trump is a new phenomenon for us to deal with. Arch racist, completely reactionary, disgusting on every level. And yet, who is most responsible? Now, who gave him endless coverage every single night during the presidential campaigns? CNN, even MSNBC. Every one of the major media gave an overwhelming attention to his campaign while expressing, oh, they're so concerned, but it was overwhelmingly favorable and friendly coverage. Then he's elected, and instead they want to blame a Russian blog for tipping the election. It doesn't even bear reason or sanity when you consider their coverage.
And, of course, the emails show that the Democratic National Committee also favored the Republicans nominating Trump.
That's right. I mean, there was a coming together that is absolutely bizarre. So here we are with Trump, racist, sexist, attacks on LGBTQ, attacks on immigrants, attacks on Muslims, and naming the most reactionary appointments. Are we going to put our confidence in the very political party that raised no real opposition to him? Or are we going to put our confidence, our determination in building independent organizational resistance to him? And this is a choice that forces today really have to make. And it's becoming much, much more dangerous. Now, we could look at the newest threats on Russia. Supposedly, an expelled Russian double agent of no value whatsoever. I mean, he's handed back to the British in an exchange. No value whatsoever. An old has-been is poisoned. Nobody dies. But because of that, not only is Britain expelling diplomats, and the U.S. is expelling diplomats, Russian diplomats, 22 countries have expelled Russian diplomats, all over a poisoning case that Britain refuses to even have an investigation or a serious inquiry of. It's a completely whipped up and contrived attack on Russia, and it's very, very dangerous because these are the things which, when you look at developments in Syria, when you look at developments in Iran, in Ukraine, what pushes a bigger button? And there's no reason for it except the crisis that U.S. and British imperialism and all the others find themselves in, that their power is shrinking and their ability to impose their will is shrinking. So they're taking more and more drastic and really fruitless efforts. I think there's a lot that's happening that's very ominous. You wonder, where does this go? The scale of the crisis, the things that are happening, recalling diplomats, well, that's just a gesture. That's not so important. But it is a sign of what's happening. We can see the massive destruction in Syria, a third of the population and more displaced by the U.S. effort of regime change, but it hasn't succeeded. So we need to both take confidence, I think stand stronger than ever before with all people who are resisting the U.S. empire, and not put any of our confidence in the Republican or the Democratic Party, because both of them are the parties of war, and the parties of war right here at home also.
Mm-hmm. It is distressing to see that not only governments, but intelligence agencies or even other private actors can cause what appear to be serious global crises by making accusations and not being required to bring any proof whatsoever if the accusation is against Putin or the Koreans.
That's exactly true. And that has been U.S. conduct, British conduct, for well over 100 years. Look at a whole war against the people of Iraq. Complete destruction of the entire country over a completely discredited claim that no one, even at the time, believed about weapons of mass destruction. So these charges are very dangerous to make. They're completely fraudulent. We could go all the way back to the Gulf of Tonkin and remember the Maine. This is the way U.S. fights wars. They make an outrageous, unsubstantiated claim, demand that there be an immediate answer. They're really demanding total capitulation. And then they use it as an excuse to stage a war. It's very dangerous. Every time it's used today, and we can see that from what's happened in the past. And it means millions of lives lost there and here, because the wars do come home. Every bomb that falls there falls here too, in cities of the U.S.
That was Sarah Flounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition.
A New Jersey State Supreme Court judge dealt a blow to Newark Mayor Ross Baraka's effort to establish a civilian complaint review board with the power to investigate and subpoena the police. The judge sided with the Fraternal Order of Police Union in ruling that the board constitutes a violation of police officers' right to due process. We spoke with Larry Hamm, chairman of POP, the People's Organization for Progress, which has been fighting police brutality in northern New Jersey for almost 40 years. Hamm says the judge's ruling is a serious setback.
As you know, Glenn, we've been fighting in Newark, New Jersey for over half a century, trying to get a police review board established here in Newark. In 2014, we had both the election of the son of activist, poet, playwright, now deceased, Amiri Baraka. His son, Ross Baraka, is now the mayor of Newark. That was a victory for the people here in Newark. And Mayor Baraka was elected, and almost simultaneously, the U.S. Justice Department announced that it was calling for the implementation of a consent decree in Newark, New Jersey, to reform the police department in response to the outcries of the people in Newark about the issue of police brutality, police killings, violation of people's constitutional rights, wrongful arrests, etc. And one of the stipulations of this consent decree was the creation of some form of civilian oversight. So these two efforts converge: the effort on the part of the people to have a police review board, the effort on the part of the Justice Department to reform Newark Police. And in 2014, Mayor Ross Baraka signed an executive order to create a civilian review board in Newark. In 2015, this was followed up by the Municipal Council, the City Council of Newark. They passed an ordinance to create this police review board. So it was pushed forward with the executive order by Mayor Baraka and codified in law with the passage of the ordinance by the City Council. Well, as most people can guess, the police immediately went to work when Mayor Baraka signed the executive order. In a very public way, he signed that executive order, and the police organization went into court and subsequently have filed a motion for an injunction in state superior court, an injunction to stop all activity on the police review board, which a judge granted. And for a year, the city of Newark has been in contention with the organization, the police organizations that filed this injunction. And finally, this past week or so, Judge Kessler in state Supreme Court issued his decision on the matter. And his decision was, in fact, that the city of Newark did not have the constitutional authority to create a police review board with both subpoena power and investigatory power. Now, in our estimation, if the police review board doesn't have subpoena power and investigatory power, it's really a toothless body. And so this was a setback that the judge issued this ruling. It was quite a lengthy ruling. All reports that I received said that the judge talked at least for an hour giving his ruling, and then there was more declaration in the query that followed with both the plaintiff and the defendant, the city of Newark and the police organizations, and that the whole process of getting this ruling out in court that day lasted for most of the day, went from the morning until the afternoon. But the city of Newark has stated that it is going to appeal Judge Kessler's ruling because, you know, the people want a real police review board. They don't want a toothless police review board. They want a review board that can at least put a dent in this problem.
And the question, of course, is would you sit on a toothless review board?
The People's Organization for Progress, we have had discussions, and as you know from our past interviews on your show and your listening audience knows, we have indicated that it's likely that we would not be a part of such a body. It's really problematical. It's problematical from the point of view of dealing effectively with the problem, and it's also problematic politically for us. But we want a review board that has power. We don't want a review board that doesn't have power, because we have had examples of both. And in Essex County, there were other municipalities that had what they call police review boards, but these review boards, we would call them review committees or citizens' bodies. They didn't have any investigatory power. They didn't have a subpoena power. I don't even know if any of them are actually up and running at this time. And so we want a review board with power. And it's going to be interesting to see how this whole situation works out.
Well, the judge not only agreed with the cops, and the cops claimed that the review board having these subpoena powers and all would deny them, the cops, due process, but the judge also said that somehow the folks on the review board were liable to engage in a political business that was to no good. Political mischief is the term he used.
Well, those are his terms, and that's his opinion. We don't share his opinion, and the city of Newark does not agree with his opinion, and we know that because the city has indicated that it is going to appeal the judge's decision. It's clear that the judge came down four square on the side of the police, and this gives people, grassroots people, more insight. Really not telling them anything new, not saying anything we didn't already know, but it helps to confirm what we already believe, that the entire system, the police, the courts, the criminal justice system, works for the most part in tandem. All of their parts work in tandem against the people whenever it comes to the issue of police brutality. So we have already had a demonstration and press conference stating our opposition to Judge Kessler's decision this past Wednesday. NCAP, which is a citywide coalition of organizations, which include the ACLU, the NAACP, the People's Organization for Progress, the Newark Anti-Violence Coalition, and other organizations, NCAP, had a demonstration on Wednesday afternoon in opposition to Judge Kessler's decision, and again outlining support for the city of Newark in terms of filing an appeal on this matter. We are going to keep fighting for a police review board that at least has the powers that other review boards have, like New York City, because New York City has a review board that has subpoena power and investigatory power. So we want a review board like that. And I have to say also that the reason Judge Kessler talks about community groups is because our review board was one of the few review boards established that actually had places for community organizations that have been active in the fight against police brutality to actually sit as members of this review board. So you can see from Judge Kessler's decision that they not only wanted to pull the teeth of the police review board, but they didn't want grassroots people who've been fighting against police brutality to have a voice in the process of reviewing police negative conduct and bad behavior. They don't even want us to have a voice in that. And it just gives you further insight as to how this system works against the people.
Now, this review board is clearly a creation, a creature of the mayor, and POP has been supportive of the mayor. But if there's not going to be a police review board, not one that you can sit on, then doesn't POP have to review its stance in terms of how it opposes police abuses within Newark itself?
Absolutely. The answer to that question is yes, we would have to review our position regarding the review board. And we have been doing so all along in this process. Glenn, you know, because you have been interviewing representatives of POP periodically over the past 2 years about this police review board. You know that all along the way, we have been assessing and analyzing the kind of review board that was going to be established. Now, what has happened in the last 2 years since the Justice Department came in and since the consent decree has been implemented, and I'm speaking anecdotally here, we've seen one major case, at least I'll say this, one case that made it to the newspapers of the police abusing a young Hispanic man. In fact, they had injured him. But the mayor, the next day, it was announced that the mayor had suspended these police officers. So we've had situations of police brutality in Essex County, in New Jersey, but in the city of Newark, since the Justice Department has come in, since the implementation of the consent decree, since the establishment of the police review board, we haven't had major cases which required us to mobilize in that way. But if a situation arises where we have cases like there were in the past before 2014, when the Justice Department came in, we had cases like Rashid Fuquan Moore, who had been killed by the police, and many others. We were always mobilizing, organizing, engaging in direct action to protest police brutality. And that's going to continue. That would even continue even if we had a police review board. If we have a police review board, if we win this, and we win a police review board that has subpoena power and investigatory power, if the police unjustly kill somebody in Newark tomorrow, there will be a demonstration. And the People's Organization for Progress will be in that demonstration, I guarantee.
You seem to be saying that the Justice Department's intervention has had a strong and lasting prophylactic effect on the cops in Newark.
I would say this, anecdotally, and I say anecdotally with a purpose because I actually haven't read any statistics, because you got to keep in mind that a lot of stuff happens that doesn't make the newspapers. A lot of stuff happens that does. Every abuse by the police does not make it to the newspapers, the radio, the media, the public sphere. A lot goes on. And we would actually have to see some statistics to make some really conclusive assessment. So whenever I speak about this, I have to say anecdotally, because I'm talking about what I know about either personally or through the newspapers up until this point. But I'm cognizant of the fact that that may not be the whole picture. So anecdotally, yes, since the Justice Department has come in, there has been what seems to be an ameliorative effect. Since the Justice Department came in, since they mandated that there had to be civilian oversight of the police, since the election of Mayor Baraka, since the appointment, not of one, but several new police directors we've had in succession, since Mayor Baraka came into office, yes, it does seem that there have been less cases of police killing than there were prior to 2014.
Now, of course, Newark had its great rebellion in 1967, and Pop has marked that event. But coming up, we have the 50th anniversary of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, which, of course, was accompanied by massive civil disturbances in Black America.
Absolutely. This Wednesday coming, April 4th, will be the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. Dr. King was killed, and we could say, in a manner of speaking, that Dr. King was himself a victim of police brutality, that is, state brutality, because his wife went into federal court in 1999, and the outcome of that case was that a judge ruled, in fact, that Dr. King had been the victim of a conspiracy that, in fact, had involved numerous intelligence agencies in the United States. So this is a matter of record now, of court record, that Dr. King was a victim of state violence. And we know the police are one of those apparatus force of the state. So we will be having our annual commemoration, because People's Organization for Progress, we have been celebrating the birth of Dr. King, and we've also been commemorating the assassination of Dr. King for many years now. So this is not a first event for us. But it is different in that it marks the 50th anniversary, a half century since his assassination. And as you know, with these anniversaries, 50th and 100th and so on and so forth, these are times when people generally stand back and try to assess what has happened over the last 50 years. Not only is it the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King, but it's also the 50th anniversary of the publication of the Kerner Commission report, which, Glenn, the Kerner Commission was assembled after the assassination of Dr. King to assess the state of race and race relations in the United States. And the phrase that has come down for the past 50 years, the bottom line on the Kerner Commission report, was that America was moving toward two societies, separate and unequal, one black and one white. And so there already have been a number of articles that have come out where people have assessed the state of race relations, racial equality or racial inequality in the United States. And the reports are not good, because in some respects, there have been some improvements in the situation of African Americans here in the United States. But in many of those areas that were measured in 1968, not only do we not show improvement, we actually show that in some respects, the situation has actually worsened since 1968. I know this might be hard for some people to accept, because the media has focused on the strides of the black upper classes, you know, the black millionaire class. And there is a small class, very small, but there is a class of black wealthy people in the United States. And there's the black middle class. And these upper classes have been the primary benefactors of racial progress over the past 50 years. But the conditions of the masses of black people, who are working people and poor people, in many ways, their plight is actually worse than it was in 1968. So this is what we're going to highlight next week, because the People's Organization for Progress, we will be marching on Wednesday, April 4th. We're gathering at 4:30 at the Martin Luther King Monument in Newark, New Jersey, on the corner of Martin Luther King Boulevard and Springfield Avenue. And we're going to march throughout downtown Newark, and we're going to rally. And at our rally, we're going to highlight, not just highlight the fact, highlight the adverse conditions that the African American community finds itself in 2018, but also talk about how these conditions are the product of a system, that these conditions are not accidental, that these conditions are not just the product of public policy, although public policy has its role too, but that these conditions are the outcome of how the capitalist system has functioned over the years to produce racial inequality in America, throughout American history, not just since the past 50 years since Dr. King was assassinated, but from the very day this country was founded and from the very day that African Americans were forcibly brought into the Western Hemisphere as a result of the slave trade and enslavement of black people, then that this economic system has functioned to our detriment.
You keep talking like that, and somebody might label you a black identity extremist.
Well, believe me, if I was labeled such, I would wear it as a badge of honor. I would also get me a lawyer, because I know if they put that label on me, that means that the Justice Department would be trying to move to shut us down. So I would certainly circle up the wagon, but believe me, I would not wear it as a badge of dishonor. I would wear it as a badge of honor, because we cannot mince words when we talk about why black people are in the state that we're in today. As Amilcar Cabral said, tell no lies, claim no easy victories. We have to tell the truth. And Dr. King told that truth. At the end of his life, if people read Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, and you read that book called The World House, Dr. King was critical of the system of capitalism, what he called the system of monopoly capitalism. He was critical both of capitalism and imperialism. In his book, Where Do We Go From Here, regarding the capitalist system in the United States, he said we needed a radical redistribution of power and wealth and we needed a radical transformation of our socioeconomic system. Those were his exact words. And in his speech, A Time to Break the Silence, where he came out on April 4th, 1967, that speech was given at Riverside Church in New York City. Exactly a year to the day later, April 4th, 1968, he was assassinated. And I believe he was assassinated because he said that the Vietnam War was an imperialist war and was an unjust war and wasn't an accident, but was in fact the product of an economic system that in fact benefits from war. And so when we rally on Dr. King's birthday, we have to speak in his tradition, and that is speak truth to power and tell the truth as best we understand it as to why our people are suffering at home and abroad.
That was Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey.
The police killing of Stephon Clark in Sacramento, California, shocked Black communities across the nation. In New York City, activists clash with police at demonstrations in Manhattan. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Shannon Jones, a Bronxite for NYPD accountability. Jones says Stephon Clark was the victim of a shoot the black man on sight policy.
Well, from what we understand, and this is based on mass media reports, which are always cautioned in of itself, is Stephon Clark was in his grandmother's backyard, and the police were allegedly responding to a call of burglaries or auto break-ins, and they allegedly making the claim that Stephon Clark charged at them, resulting in them shooting him or firing 20 rounds. Come to find out, he was in his own grandmother's backyard. The front doorbell doesn't work, so people typically go to the side or to the back to knock to alert other family members that someone needs to get in. So what we know now is 20 rounds were fired and 6 hit Stephon Clark in the back, 1 in the upper torso area and 1 in the thigh, which suggested that, you know, he was fired upon from the back. He was not facing the officers at all, which is in direct contradiction to them fearing for their life, and he was charging at them. So as far as my organization, Bronxites for NYPD Accountability, also known as Y Accountability, it's part of the dog and pony show where state violence is completely going unchecked when it comes to the African in this country. So this is where we are. There was a particular point in late 2016 and largely throughout 2017 where unarmed killing from police officers to black people were not going reported or weren't quote-unquote hashtagged or turned into a mass mind control media frenzy. So Stephon Clark, the 20 shots, gives people vibes from Amadou Diallo and Sean Bell and Laquan from Chicago. So these are problematic, to say the least, the work that we have to do as Africans in this country to adequately address this problem and continue to fight for our liberation has oftentimes left me speechless in this situation. Really, really has.
We know that the claim was that these slave catchers thought that they saw a gun or some kind of weapon. And, of course, we know now that there was no such weapon. What is your interpretation of that pattern on the part of these slave catchers?
At this point, it's total lies. It's total lies. 2018, 80% of people have a cell phone. 100% of people, or 99 and 44 to 100% of people are going to be walking around with a wallet. So there is always going to be some object on a person that you can use to flick them into terminating on sight. That's where we are, and that's where we've been. This is on a continuum. So when the police say we thought it was a gun and it was a cell phone. No, it's we terminated him on site, and because he has a cell phone, we could say we thought a gun was a cell phone. This is where we are. Someone could say they thought my earring was a gun because it glistened and it looked like an ivory grip on a gun. Please. The cover-ups are getting sloppier and sloppier because we're not working hard enough as Africans. We got to do the work. And I don't know if we'll get to it in this conversation, but we're going to have to do some serious calling out and exposing of the formulas that white supremacy puts in place to derail us using our own black people. And we have to call that out to uproot it, because I'm already seeing it playing out with the Stephon Clark situation.
Yeah, so let's get into that. I certainly recognize, for example, the involvement of one Reverend Al Sharpton as a part of perhaps this formula that you're speaking of. Is that the kind of issue that you're pointing toward?
Right. That's just really a slice of the pie. I want to broaden it for a moment to make sure that listeners understand. When we get information as the general body politic or masses, other folk already know the information. It's just coming to us. So trust and believe, the police department knew within hours that he was shot in the back, not days, for it to be revealed to us now. That was already known. So we have to accept that there's an effort of collusion in this country to corral black anger and channel it to a dead-end driveway, a place where it falls into an abyss rather than make substantial change for our liberation. That collusion effort takes on certain forms, and one of those forms is bringing out folks that are going to use derailing language, folks that are going to mislead the family members into the wrong type of language and the wrong type of actions that don't lead to black liberation. National Action Network is one of them. It still baffles my mind how people can continue to support an organization where it's already been revealed that its head was an FBI informant. This makes no sense to me. I don't get it. I don't understand how that still is even going on, not unless it's being supported by blacks that are receiving peripheral benefit from white supremacy, because if we remember very clearly, Ferguson activists told Jesse Jackson, get your butt up out of Ferguson. Baltimore activists told Al Sharpton, get your butt up out of Baltimore. So there is a section of people that do get it. I don't want to make it sound like it's all about him, because it certainly is not, because the next onslaught to divide the people and to quell anger and to derail black liberation efforts through grassroots work is to now what I'm seeing within the past 24 hours, 36 hours, is an examination of Stephon Clark's tweets and social media sentiments, which run the gamut of anti-blackness, particularly directed at black women, his expressions of preference for Asian women and or white women. So now the chatter on social media is about, does he deserve justice in any way, or black women withdrawing their support? So white supremacy is crafty. And we have to do better. We have to really understand what is going on here in order to expose and break down those things that are intended to harm us. Funny enough, people are planning Stephon Clark rallies and marches on the same day as April 4th, Martin Luther King. And I find that funny because they will preface these actions with silence. Martin Luther King is becoming the most disrespected black man in America, because anytime it's time for black people to compromise or lay down or be quiet or be docile, Martin Luther King gets invoked. And that's such a disrespect to his name and to his memory. So there are actions planned in the city of New York well after the action that took place here on Wednesday night, which was an unpermitted protest with 1,000 people from Columbus Circle through Hell's Kitchen to Times Square for Stephon Clark.
Can you share a bit more about how that went? What kind of response did you get from those around you, law enforcement, etc.?
The shutdown for Stephon Clark was on Wednesday, March 28th at 7 p.m. at Columbus Circle. It was put together by NYC Shut It Down, the Grand Central Crew, and People's Power Assemblies. As we all know, the Grand Central Crew have done unpermitted protests every Monday night for 3 years. In 2018, what they've done with the last Monday of the month is do a food serve in order to conduct a Serve the People program. So salute to them. And People's Power Assemblies is an assembly group out of Manhattan, which has a very strong radical leaning and has done great street action work over several years. We had a crowd stretching over blocks, taking the streets of Hell's Kitchen. The police were extremely aggressive. They brought out all of their possible equipment, from LRADs to motorbikes. It was just outrageous. 13 people arrested. The aggression was extreme. Even NYPD Legal were jumping on people. There are pictures of that on the internet, I believe, by Eric McGregor, caught amazing pictorials of some violent arrests. So that really was the totality of it. So as I said earlier, now they're going to be counteraction by derailers that are funded by white supremacy after the fact to change the tone. So now it's MLK, and we're going to be silent, and we're going to light candles and all of this nonsense. They know people are 38 hot about Mr. Clark being shot 6 times in his back for nothing.
So from your perspective, what do you see as the next steps as regards those with a view toward black liberation, the liberation of human beings, figuring out some way to stop these slave catchers from just blatantly, flagrantly killing us in the street?
That's like an existential question. We as black people often get bogged down on what we should do next or what we should do first. So you have to do this before you do that, do this, do that. I will say we need to move in a parallel format. First and foremost, we need to get political education. Political education. Because a lot of our bandwidth is spent amongst ourselves discussing basic universal principles and facts about the way this country operates. We still have too many black people not being real about our current state of affairs, and that is directly related to 10, 15, and 20 years of miseducation in European school systems. Whatever efforts we make now, we're doing it so we are not condemning our children and grandchildren to additional suffering. And I say that all the time. Anytime that us as a collective fail to act as individuals, if you don't make a personal commitment to black independence, some street action, we are condemning our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren to more suffering, more Stephon Clarks, more Sean Bells, more Amadou Diallo, more Akai Gurley, more Ayanna Jones, more Rakia Boyd, more Chantel Davis, more Mike Brown, more Eric Garner. We can continue to go on and on and on, which is really, really devastating for our community. So I hope everyone really thinks about that and corral with their neighbors, friends, and family, because it ain't happening on Facebook. Revolution ain't happening on Facebook. You may interact with some folks that may be like-minded, but then when you guys decide to meet in person and put something together, then now you're cooking with grease. But it's not going to happen across this social media with hashtags and retweeting think pieces. It just is not. So we have to do more than that. Because this social media surveillance tool is also a gear down shifter as well. It's not only for surveillance. It's to keep our gear shifted down where we're not doing what we need to do.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.